Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 resident. Today we'll be going through the 46th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts, and this will be the third installation of a Neurology Clerkship Shelf Review. This is just a pickup from yesterday, pretty much. So again, I'll try to go through some neurology material, and hopefully by the end of this series, you should have a fairly thorough review for the neuro clerkship. And I apologize, it's not like one big like video like I did for the other clerkships. I just really don't have the recording equipment, that's one. I was able to obtain that from my school back in the day. And I also don't have like 2 hours to like just record stuff because I'm currently on rotations as a PGY1. So that makes things a little difficult. So I have to sort of break things up into bits and pieces. But overall, you should get the whole same message, just in smaller chunks. So let's get started, right? So the first slide says a child is not doing well in school. His teacher often observes him staring into space with no awareness of his surroundings, right? So this is a child. This is a pediatric question. So what's your diagnosis, right? So obviously this is an absence seizure, okay? Don't forget that on EEGs, right, you find the 3 hertz spike and basically just look for the buzzword 3 hertz. And the way you treat this is with ethosuximide. Ethosuximide is actually a calcium channel blocker, but more specifically, it's a T-type calcium channel blocker, okay? And again, absence seizures will be something that will show up in a kid on your exam. It's not going to show up in an adult. So always look at age ranges on tests. So especially on the MBMEs, they're usually pretty helpful in delineating what's going on. Now, second question, a 55-year-old female presents with a 6-month history of feeling like the room is spinning around her that lasts for about 3 days at a time. She has also had difficulty hearing at home, right? So she has hearing loss. She has a feeling of the room spinning. Okay. She also complains of a ringing sound in her ear, right? So that's tinnitus, right? So what's your diagnosis? Well, I really hope you're sort of putting together the triad here, right? So like vertigo, tinnitus, which is ringing in the ears, and hearing loss, okay? It's actually a sensory neural hearing loss. That's pretty classic for Meniere's disease, okay? And the dietary modification that at least helps in Meniere's disease is like eating like a low-salt diet. In terms of pharmacologic management, you can try to calm down like the vertiginous symptoms by giving anticholinergic agents, right? So like scopolamine or meclizin or even Benadryl, right? So diphenhydramine. That can help with the nausea and the vertigo. Alternatively, you could also give diuretics. Some people actually respond pretty well to diuretics with Meniere's disease. But if you want definitive treatment, you actually have to ablate the 8th cranial nerve, okay? You essentially do that by injecting gentamicin into the ear. Remember, gentamicin is a 30S inhibitor. It's bactericidal. It's an aminoglycoside. Aminoglycosides are ototoxic, so you can use that ototoxic effect to just ablate the 8th cranial nerve, and that can essentially resolve Meniere's disease. The only problem is the patient will also have a permanent sensory neurohearing loss with that. And the pathophysiology behind Meniere's disease is kind of shaky, but the buzzword you kind of want to remember for exams is something known as endolymphatic high drops, okay? Endolymphatic high drops. And endolymphatic high drops, right, it just means that, oh, so think of high drops, right? So if something is hydropic, it means it's swelling, right? So sort of think of this in the context of like poor reabsorption of endolymph in the ear, okay? And that classically causes like increased endolymphatic pressures, and that can create the clinical presentation of Meniere's disease, right? So if they tell you a patient even has a feeling of fullness in their ear or something, again, you really want to think about Meniere's disease. But classically in exam questions, they will give you the other triad of vertigo, tinnitus, and hearing loss. Okay, and just a quick word on some of these vestibular disorders, because they're kind of hard to tell apart. So let me just try to be as obvious as possible in my descriptions of these, right? So I've talked about Meniere's disease, right? Classically presents with vertigo, tinnitus, and sensory neurohearing loss, right? Now, another one is BPPV, benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. This will probably come up in a later podcast, but I'll just talk about it right now. Basically, right, you have like displacement of the otoconia in the ear, right? Classically in the posterior semicircular canal, right? So those people tend to have positional vertigo, right? So it's not like they're sitting still and they have vertigo. If they have changes in position, that's where the vertiginous, that's when the vertiginous symptoms begin to show up, right? And remember that these people do not have any kind of hearing loss. That's important to know. And remember that you can make the diagnosis with the Dick's Hall pipe maneuver, and you can potentially treat this with the Epley maneuver. That's the most common answer you see on exams. So I've talked about Meniere's disease. I've talked about BPPV. Now, the third one I want to talk about is vestibular neuronitis. Okay, vestibular neuronitis. Classically, this shows up after a patient has had like a viral upper respiratory infection. And then they tell you that they have like just constant vertigo. So it's not positional like BPPV. Okay, this one is not positional, like sitting still, they still have vertiginous symptoms. They still feel like the room is spinning around them. And it's constant, it's pretty severe, and it can last for days to weeks before it resolves on its own. Okay, so it's not positional, okay, but it classically arises on exams after viral upper respiratory infections. And vestibular neuronitis is not very high yield. It is not associated with hearing loss. However, if they give you an exam question where they describe symptoms of vestibular neuronitis and then they tell you that the patient also has hearing loss, then think about labyrinthitis. Labyrinthitis is basically vestibular neuronitis plus hearing loss. So that's what I'm going to say about the vestibular disorders. I'll say some more stuff about them down the line. Now, the next slide, hit in the head with a bat, passed out for less than 30 seconds, finished out the game, now presents with severe headache and somnolence, right? You've heard this horror story before, right? This is obviously an epidural hematoma, okay? And the diagnostic testing you want to do, right? You want to do a non-con head CT. Remember, blood will serve as its own contrast. And on the non-contrast head CT, right, you obviously see the lens-shaped hematoma, okay? For these patients, you obviously do not want to do a lumbar puncture, right? Because if you do that, you will, let's just say you'll have a lot of problems with the legal system down the line. But basically, you don't want to do that, right? So that they don't hernia and die. And the pathophysiology, right, it's basically like if you have like a fracture of like the temporal bone, right, and you sort of transect the middle meningeal artery. Remember, that's like a branch of the maxillary artery, which is the terminal branch of the external carotid artery. Okay, so you basically lacerate the middle meningeal artery, and then you have an arterial bleed. Okay, and it's above the dura. It's an epidural hematoma. Okay, and the way you treat this, you basically call your friendly neurosurgeon so they can help you evacuate the hematoma. If not, this thing is rapidly fatal. And in terms of reducing intracranial pressures, right? So there are many things that you can use to reduce intracranial pressures, right? So you can elevate the head of the bed to like 30 degrees. You can hyperventilate the patient, right? Because think about it. If a patient hyperventilates, the CO2 tension goes down, right? And when your CO2 tension goes down, that actually causes a cerebral vasoconstriction. So that sort of decreases blood flow to the brain. Okay, in fact, that's actually the quickest means of reducing ICP. Very high yield to know that. It's the quickest acute means of reducing ICP, hyperventilation. Okay, other things you can do, you can give mannitol, right? So mannitol, it's an osmotic diuretic. You can give acetazolamide, although mannitol is probably a better answer on tests. You can also place a VP shunt, but that's more for like chronic management. That's not something that's going to help you much in the acute phase. And subdural hematomas, right, these classically show up in one of two people on tests, right? So old person, probably taking warfarin, has had falls, and then over the last couple of weeks, like having like this bad dementia, sort of like acting out of it, right? Think about a subdural hematoma. And then another patient population you also want to think about a subdural hematoma in is an alcoholic, right? So alcoholics, right, they may have like, essentially like they have like sort of like a microcephaly from that alcoholism, right? So their brains kind of get shrinked, and the box of their brain, which is the skull, stays the same size. So as that ball, their brain keeps like jerking around in the skull, you can imagine that they potentially shear the bridging veins, and that can cause a venous bleed. Okay, so that's a subdural hematoma. And actually, one of the last high yield scenarios is a shaking baby syndrome. Shaking baby syndrome classically presents as a subdural hematoma on exams. Okay, and remember again, it's from the rupture of the bridging veins, it's a venous bleed, so it's a lower pressure bleed. The treatment is probably about the same as an epidural hematoma, and don't forget that it looks like a crescent on non-contrast head CT imaging. Okay, so next question, super tense muscles and a temperature of 105 after intubation. So obviously, right, you should hopefully think about this as malignant hyperthermia, okay? Remember, the pathophysiology involves mutations in the dihydropyridine receptor and the ryanodine receptor. In fact, these are actually autosomal dominant inherited, okay? So dihydropyridine receptor, ryanodine receptor, and basically by having all those problems, you have an increased extrusion of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum into the cytosol of skeletal muscle. And when you have that, you have like a hypercontractile state. You generate a ton of heat, right? And that can cause super elevated body temperatures. Okay. So this is malignant hyperthermia, autosomal dominant inheritance. Okay. And the way you treat this, you actually treat it with dantrolene, right? So I just said that. Remember, the ryanodine receptor is basically like, think of the ryanodine and the dihydropyridine receptors as being like calcium channel conduits, if you may. So if you know that you have a problem where your calcium channels are not functioning well, it should make sense that you should give a calcium channel blocker like dantrolene. Dantrolene is think of it as like a ryanodine receptor antagonist. It's a calcium channel blocker that basically prevents the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and that helps in treating the symptoms of malignant hyperthermia. And if a patient has malignant hyperthermia, right, they could potentially have like muscle necrosis, right? So if you actually think about it, remember, potassium is primarily an intracellular ion. So when cells begin to die, like muscle cells, they can extrude a lot of potassium into the serum. And that potassium, right, first, so you obviously have a hyperkalemia. That hyperkalemia will first manifest as peaked T waves, okay? If the potassium keeps going up and you don't do anything to treat it, you'll then begin to have white QRS complexes. If nothing happens, right, so if it's not caught at that point, you keep going, you basically form like a sine wave EKG. And then after that, you go into asystole, which is obviously a bad outcome. Right. And remember, right, if a patient has hyperkalemia, the first thing you do to stabilize the myocardium is to give calcium gluconate, right? And then after that, you can give like insulin that increases the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump. So you dump you begin to get redistribute potassium from the extracellular environment to the intracellular environment, right? Or you can give a beta-2 agonist like albuterol, right? That can also drive potassium into cells. Another thing you could also do is to give sodium bicarb, right? So remember, sodium bicarb can create a metabolic alkalosis. Okay, when you create a metabolic alkalosis in the blood, right, you draw hydrogen ions out of cells. To maintain electron neutrality, as those hydrogen ions are coming out, potassium goes in reverse. So again, that also leads to potassium entry into the intracellular environment, sorry. And then another thing you can do is you can give K-oxalate, right? So K-oxalate makes K exit out of your body. Okay, so K-oxalate actually helps you get rid of potassium. You could also give like furosemide, right? So it's a loop diuretic, has hypokalemia as a side effect. So you basically use the potassium wasting function of loop diuretics to help you get rid of some potassium. And then if a patient has malignant hyperthermia, right, and they have elevated creatinine, right, hopefully you're thinking about rhabdomyolysis. Okay, so basically the muscle cells that have died, the myoglobin goes and clogs up the kidneys. Obviously, the way you treat that is you just do like vigorous hydration, vigorous diuresis to just wash away that myoglobin. Now, same presentation, so super tense muscles, high temperature, blah blah blah. But this is after starting flufenazine. Hopefully, you remember that flufenazine is a first generation, high potency, typical antipsychotic. So this is obviously neuroleptic malignant syndrome. Okay, treatment is the same, right? You can give dantrolene, but actually you have other options here. You can actually also give a dopamine agonist like bromocriptine or cabergoline. Alternatively, you can give a benzodiazepine like lorazepam, for example. That can also help in neuroleptic malignant syndrome. Now, last part of this question says history of depression, so potentially a patient taking SSRIs, and then treatment for Staph aureus bacteremia, or so that's like, I don't know, maybe like linezolid, if you may, or migraines, right? So maybe like sumatriptan, which is a serotonin receptor agonist. Okay, they tell you that this patient presents with high fevers, diarrhea, and clonus, right? So hopefully this gets you thinking about serotonin syndrome. Okay, remember, you don't want to combine two serotonergic agents, not a good idea, right? So history of depression, right? So think about SSRIs, SNRIs, MAOIs, TCAs, right? Staph aureus bacteremia, think about linezolid. Remember, linezolid, yes, it's a 50S inhibitor, and it covers MRSA and vancomycin-resistant enterococcus, but it also has weak monoamine oxidase inhibiting activity, so it can actually boost your levels of serotonin and trigger serotonin syndrome. And then don't forget your triptans that are used for the treatment of migraines, okay? They are serotonin receptor agonists, so they can also trigger serotonin syndrome when combined with another serotonergic agent. And then don't forget from my discussion of Parkinson's disease yesterday, right? Like your MAO-B inhibitors like selegiline or sertraline can also trigger similar symptoms, or your MDMA, right? Ecstasy. It's a serotonergic agent. It can also trigger those problems. Okay. So those patients, they present with high fevers, diarrhea, clonus, you're thinking about serotonin syndrome. Usually you give a benzodiazepine and supportive care, and that's usually fine. But on exams, one commonly sought after answer is ciproheptadine. Ciproheptadine is an antihistamine with powerful serotonin receptor blocking activity. So it's actually used quite commonly to treat serotonin syndrome. Now, next question says, tremors 6 hours after the successful completion of a AAA repair in a business executive, right? This is obviously, this person begins to go into alcohol withdrawal, right? And basically, your prevention is you give benzos, right? You can give like, if a patient is actively seizing from like delirium tremens, you obviously give the person a short-acting benzo like lorazepam, right? But if you're trying to like prophylax, you can actually give a long-acting benzodiazepine like, the trade name is Librium. What's the real name? Clodiazepoxide is a long-acting benzodiazepine that can be used to prophylax. Classically, it's used like in the CEWA protocol. You'll learn about this when you become a resident to sort of prevent delirium tremens. Okay. Now, the next part of this question is tremors after studying indapamide, right? So what is indapamide? Indapamide is it's a thiazide diuretic. So indapamide, it's a thiazide diuretic, and then they tell you that a patient has tremors after studying this drug, and they tell you that they have a history of episodes where they spend tons of money and jump into severe depression, right? So this is like, oh, this person is manic and this person is depressive, right? So hopefully you're thinking about bipolar disorder and you're thinking of lithium as the treatment. So the thing is, diuretics classically can actually raise a person's lithium levels, and that can cause lithium toxicity. And one of the telltale signs on exams of lithium toxicity is tremors. Okay, so that's one high yield thing you want to keep in mind. And really, like, there are many things that can cause lithium toxicity, and people always say, oh, come on, Divine, how am I supposed to remember all this stuff? Well, let me give you one general principle. If you can organize, if you can think of the scenario you get on a test in the context of this principle, you should be able to resolve answers to the most of these questions almost 100% of the time. So here's the principle. The principle is anything that ultimately causes an activation of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system will increase lithium toxicity. And I'll give you some quick pathophysiology on that, right? So basically, if your renin angiotensin aldosterone system is revved up, you'll ultimately at some point in the cycle make aldosterone. If you go to the principal cell of the nephron, aldosterone causes an increased reabsorption of sodium, right, through that INEC channel at the principal cell. If you go back to college chemistry, remember that sodium is a group 1 element. Lithium is also a group 1 element. So if your renin angiotensin aldosterone system is revved up, your aldosterone levels are high, that INEC channel is working better than normal, reabsorbing a ton of sodium. You can also kind of remember, it's kind of like gesticulates that you could also be reabsorbing a lot of lithium at the same time, right? So you boost your lithium levels and you get into trouble. So anything that activates your renin angiotensin system, like being volume depleted, for example, if you're taking a diuretic, can make a person have elevated lithium levels and you can get into trouble. NSAIDs, right? NSAIDs also activate the renin angiotensin system, right? Because if you take an NSAID, you inhibit cyclooxygenase, so you make less prostaglandins. And if you make less prostaglandins, you have less dilation of the afferent arteriole. And if the afferent arteriole is not dilated, your afferent arteriole will be hypoperfused. Those will make your GG cells get mad, and then they begin to secrete a ton of renin. And then that kickstarts the whole cascade. Okay, so next slide. Child presents with bulging fontanelles and somnolence. What is the most likely region of stenosis responsible for the presenting hydrocephalus? This is just a factoid you need to know. The cerebral aqueduct of Sylvius, remember that's a part of the midbrain, that's the most common region of stenosis in a patient that has like a congenital hydrocephalus. Okay, next question. 70-year-old female that is forgetful. She staggers into the exam room. Okay, so she's forgetful. She staggers into the exam room. So she has dementia. Well, let's say she has dementia, staggers into the exam room, okay, sort of create a mental picture of a person staggering into an exam room. And then they tell you she has a history of recurrent perianal sores from urinary incontinence. So this patient is wet, this patient is wacky, and this patient is wobbly. What does this sound like? Well, I hope you're thinking about normal pressure hydrocephalus. Okay, so these people, right, hydrocephalus, that tells you that you have to probably obtain some kind of brain imaging. Okay, you obtain brain imaging and you will see like enlarged ventricles. You're like, that's not good, right? So you see signs of hydrocephalus on imaging. But if you actually do a lumbar puncture in these patients, you actually will not detect elevated CSF pressures. That's why it's called normal pressure hydrocephalus. Okay, and really the way you treat this on tests is you can do like a VP shunt. Ventriculoperitoneal shunt. That's basically the most common treatment that you see on exams. Now, next question, tuberous sclerosis, right? So this is autosomal dominant inheritance, okay? Remember, it's basically the pathophysiology involves like two genes. One is called TSC1 and the other is called TSC2. If I'm not mistaken, I believe TSC1 codes for a protein known as hemartin. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe TSC2 codes for a protein known as tuberin. So if you have mutations in hemartin and tuberin, those are actually tumor suppressor genes. So if you have mutations in tumor suppressor genes, you can sort of imagine that tumors will no longer be suppressed. So tumors will start growing everywhere, right? For example, in the brain, you can have subependymal tubers growing, right? They're usually like calcified masses in the brain. In the kidneys, you can have tumors growing, right? Classically, they are angiomyolipomas, right? So angiomyolipoma, so it contains fat, muscle, and blood vessels, right? So renal angiomyolipomas, they are classic tumors and tuberous sclerosis. In terms of cardiac findings, right? Hopefully you're thinking about the cardiac rhabdomyoma. Okay, and then in this on the skin, right, you are hopefully thinking about the hypopigmented macules, right? So those are your ash leaf spots. Please do not confuse your ash leaf spots, which are hypopigmented macules that are classically associated with tuberous sclerosis, with cafe au lait spots, which are hyperpigmented macules that are classically found in the context of neurofibromatosis or I guess some Fanconi anemia. Okay, so don't mix those things up. And remember that patients with tuberous sclerosis, right, they tend to have like profound mental retardation. Well, I shouldn't use that terminology. Profound intellectual disability. Okay, that's the appropriate term. So I apologize for that. Classically, when they hit 6 months of age on MBME exams, they can tell you, they can basically describe a child with TS, and they tell you that the child wakes up and his hands begin to like vibrate and he has like generalized seizures. That should make you think about infantile spasms, okay? That's also known as West syndrome. That seizure, it's actually, they love to test it on exams because the treatment is unusual. You actually treat it with ACTH, right? So like adrenal corticotropic hormone. You can also use a drug known as a vigabatrin. Vigabatrin has like GABAergic activity. It's an anti-seizure medication. Alternatively, you can also use steroids. Okay, and don't forget that infantile spasms are associated with hypsarrhythmias on the classic pattern. It's like a chaotic pattern on EEG. I would encourage you to look up a picture of this. Looks super bizarre. It's called the hypsarrhythmia. That's the classic EEG finding in an infantile spasm. Okay. Now, next slide. Mom has a history of inconsistent condom use. Okay, that's not good. She delivers a stillborn fetus with no brain. Okay, that's not great either. So this mom's baby has anencephaly, right? So no brain. And the pathophysiology, right, is basically your neural tube does not close. Anterior, wait, Let me think about this for a second. Sorry, I have to think about this, given this practically from memory. So you have failed cranial closure of your neuropores. So that is how you get an encephaly, okay? So you don't develop a brain, so you have no swallowing center. So classically, these kids have polyhydramnios. That's a classic OB-GYN shelf question. And I guess some other quick spinal dysraphisms you want to keep in mind, right? So you want to think of things like spina bifida occulta, right? So that's where you have like a congenital absence of the like spinous processes, right? And I mean, you won't see like meninges or neural tissue herniating through the defect. In fact, you may not see any like clinical signs on a physical exam, right? But like in the lumbosacral area, usually it's around like L5, S1, you'll find like a dimple or like a port wine stain or like a tuft of hair. Okay, those are pretty classic. Usually doesn't require any kind of treatment and those kids are fine. Another high yield spinal dysraphism to know is meningocele, right? So like basically you have like a herniation of like meningeal tissue and CSF, okay? It's usually through a defect in the spine, okay? And there is a buzzword pathophysiology you actually want to commit to memory for exams, okay? The buzzword pathophysiology is a failure of fusion of the posterior neural arch. Failure of fusion of the posterior neural arch. That's something you sort of want to commit to memory. And again, it usually shows up mostly in the lumbosacral area. These kids may have like a hydrocephalus, okay? And generally, for this, you have to do like some kind of neurosurgical intervention. And if you intervene neurosurgically, these kids usually do pretty well. And then the worst one is myelomeningocele. Okay, this is basically where you have like herniation of meninges and like CNS tissue through like a defect in the spine. Okay, and again, this arises because your neurotubes did not close. And remember, folic acid deficiencies, right? Deficiency of folate is like a big risk factor for a neurotube defect. But notice I'm using the term spinal dysraphism. Your friends at the MBME, right? One thing they classically do to people on tests is they take what you know and give it like a different term, okay? Just to sort of mess with your head. I mean, you probably know this example I cite all the time, like, oh, like some of my buddies being like laminated calcifications. Well, neurotube defect, think of that as a spinal dysraphism. It's basically one and the same thing. Okay, so myelomeningocele. One big high yield thing you want to remember is that if a patient has a lumbosacral myelomeningocele, it's associated with a Chiari 2 malformation, okay? Lumbosacral myelomeningoceles have an association with Chiari 2 malformations. Lock down that concept in your mind. It's a classically tested exam concept. And many times, these kids, I mean, they survive, but they tend to have some relatively serious neurologic deficits. So that's my take on the spinal dysraphisms, okay? And if you have a neurotube defect, aka spinal dysraphism, you have an elevated maternal serum AFP, right? You can also have like elevated levels of acetylcholinesterase in the amniotic fluid. That's just something to keep in mind. And while we're on this topic of elevated maternal serum AFP, if you see an exam question where they have the quad screen and the maternal serum AFP is decreased, well, hopefully you're thinking about Down syndrome, okay? Down syndrome. Now, your Chiari malformations, right? There's type 1 and type 2 Chiari malformations. In a type 1 Chiari malformation, it's one thing that herniates through the foramen magnum, right? So in this case, it's the cerebellar tonsils. Those are the things that herniate in a Chiari 1 malformation. But in a Chiari 2 malformation, you have two things herniating, okay? You have the cerebellar tonsils, and then you have the cerebellar vermis. Okay, and again, don't forget that a type 2 Chiari malformation is associated with a lumbosacral myelomeningocele. A type 1 Chiari malformation is associated with a syringomyelia. So classically, it presents with hydrocephalus. Okay, so remember like syringo, like just remember that I in syringo as a 1 to help you remember that syringomyelia is associated with a Chiari 1 malformation. Okay, and then again, Chiari 2, lumbosacral, lumbosacral myelomeningocele. Notice I'm repeating this over and over again. And I'm not repeating it for funsies. I'm repeating it because it's super high yield on tests. Now, B12 deficiency, right? Remember that it's classically associated with a subacute combined degeneration of the cord. So you basically knock out your lateral corticospinal tract and your dorsal columns, right? So your dorsal column medial lemniscus system. So you have problems with like vibration, touch, and proprioception, and you also have upper motor neuron findings. I believe in a later podcast, I'll talk about those spinal cord pathologies. And B12, if you want to differentiate it from folate deficiency, right? So we know that B12 and folate are both involved in homocysteine metabolism. So your levels of homocysteine will be high in both. Doesn't matter, right? And you can get a macrocytic or a megaloblastic anemia with both, right? But remember that methylmalonyl-CoA mutase that converts methylmalonyl-CoA to succinyl-CoA, okay, uses vitamin B12 as a cofactor. So if you have a B12 deficiency, you have a methylmalonic acidemia. So you have elevated levels of methylmalonic acid. Okay. So final question today. So cafe au lait spots plus brown pigments in the axilla plus tuber-like skin growths plus episodic headache and severe hypertension, right? So this is neurofibromatosis type 1, okay? Remember, it's associated with cafe au lait spots. Those are hyperpigmented lesions on the skin. Brown pigments on the axilla, tuber-like skin growths, right? So those are the neurofibromas. Episodic headache and severe hypertension. Actually, it's pretty high yield to know that NF1 is associated with pheochromocytomas. And the common eye malignancy they get, right? So they can get like optic nerve gliomas. In fact, that's probably one of the most common tumors in neurofibromatosis type 1. That's why you have to screen these patients commonly. You need to screen them fairly frequently for these optic nerve gliomas, right? So that's a cranial tumor mass. The common ear malignancy they tend to get acoustic neuromas, especially like neurofibromatosis type 2, okay? They tend to get bilateral acoustic neuromas, right? Those are also known as vestibular schwannomas. And on exams, right, those classically show up at the cerebellopontine angle, okay? In fact, acoustic neuromas, very high yield to know this, they are the most common CNS mass at the cerebellopontine angle. I think the second most common, if I'm not mistaken, is a meningioma. And then the iris finding, right? So these are the Lish nodules. Those are just hematomas in the iris. And then NF1 or neurofibromatosis in general is associated with meningiomas, okay? So if they tell you like, oh, sarcoma buddies from a brain biopsy in this patient population, they are getting you to think about a meningioma. Okay, remember, meningiomas classically on MBMEs, they show up like parasagittally on brain imaging. Okay, and the mechanism of inheritance of neurofibromatosis, like many other neurocutaneous disorders like tuberous sclerosis, is autosomal dominant. Okay, and the gene mutation, right, NF1, it's like chromosome 17. I believe the gene is known as a neurofibromin, and then NF2 is on chromosome 22. So NF2, chromosome 22, NF1, 17. 17 has a 1 in it. NF2, I believe it's like a Merlin gene mutation. Okay, so that's what I'm going to stop with today. I hope you've had a great day. I am certainly having a great one on my surgery rotation. I wish you all the best, and I will see you in the next podcast. God bless, and talk to you all later. Enjoy your day.